Welcome, welcome. We are back for another episode of The Lock-In. My name is David Lappin and I am joined by my now six-time poker author friend, Dara O'Kearney. Dara, your new book, Beyond GTO, is flying off the shelves, I hear. Congrats.
Thank you, David. Yeah, it's been a very good start for the book. We're very happy. We never really know how a book's going to go until it's out. There did seem to be a lot of anticipation for this one because it's a little bit different from the previous ones we've done. I'm very happy, particularly happy with the reaction so far as well. A lot of people have said they think this is our best book, which given how well some of the other books have been received is quite the accolade, but maybe people just don't remember those other books.
Well, joining us this week is an author turned poker player, turned poker author. She has written three bestsellers, including The Biggest Bluff, the story about her own poker odyssey. She is our great friend, Maria Konnikova. Maria, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me back. Always a pleasure.
Maria, we're so glad to have you back. Let's start with your recent online victory, if you don't mind. 3 weeks ago, You won a WSOP circuit ring for 57K. Am I right in saying that was your very, very first WSOP circuit tournament?
You are correct in saying that, yes. The circuit events tend to be in smaller places, you know, all over the country, and I don't really travel for them, so I've never been in the same place as a circuit event before. And I don't really play online much other than on PokerStars when I'm out of the country or when I'm in New Jersey. And I just happened to be in Las Vegas and it was really rainy outside. And so there was really not much to do. You know, it was a very rainy Sunday. So I saw this was going on and it was a very spur of the moment, last minute decision.
Well, a very fortuitous one too. Yes. Almost exactly a year ago, you had a couple of nice results at the PCA when you took seventh in the BSOP main event, and then just a few days later came 30th in the PCA main.
Yeah.
Was it nice being back in the Bahamas, your happy hunting ground, of course, the location of your PCA national victory in 2018?
It was. And it was a bittersweet final table because the event that I final tabled and came in was seventh. Yes, I forget. Yeah. I came in and you just said it. Yeah, came in seventh. That was the same event that I had won. So it would have been really awesome to go back to back and win those. But that was not to be. I got very, very unlucky and bluffed it all off into top two pair.
Well, it happens to the best of us. In October of last year,
typical cooler.
I like how she said that with complete pride, bluffed it off into top two pair.
Exactly.
That didn't knock me out. I actually still had chips left after that because I had been one of the chip leaders, but it was all over after that.
You punted. It's fine. We all punt. In October of last year, you rejoined the PokerStars team as an ambassador, having worn their colors in 2018 and 2019. It feels like, how do I put this? A very different signing this time round. Before, they were buying into Maria Konnikova, the author turned poker player who ran pure out of the gate and was full of optimism. Now I feel like they're getting a battle-scarred veteran who does laps of the property on breaks while playing out full WSOP schedule.
This is true. I'm definitely a different sort of person, not quite as a bright-eyed and bushy-tailed as I was before. But the thing that I have in common with the me of 2018 is my enthusiasm for the game and my continued belief that it's actually such an incredibly strong force for the good and a way that we can really help people be better thinkers, be better decision makers. And so I've really enjoyed bringing people into the game who used to be like me, who are like, what the hell's poker and why me gamble never. And I've really enjoyed kind of teaching people that, you know, it's not gambling, that it's something very different, that I too do not gamble. I've actually never played slots in my life and have only played table games once. I played blackjack once under duress in the Bahamas when I found a chip on the floor and was forced to play with it when the group I was with was going to play blackjack, but otherwise I've never gambled. And so it's been really wonderful bringing those people in the game and opening their eyes and watching the transformations, especially of women. I don't want to say, you know, just women because all genders welcome, but especially of women, watching them become more confident, watching them kind of use this as a way of growing, which is what happened to me. And so this time, you know, signing with PokerStars again, that is very much on my mind, right? And they are looking to really come back to North America to re-expand in the United States. And I think that That's something that I can really help with in terms of explaining how to position poker and talking to people about what poker is and what it's not.
Well, at the risk of chanting one of us, Dara, do you feel as though Maria has earned her stripes as a legit grinder now to some extent?
I never had any doubts about Maria's legitimacy as a grinder. No, I think I've always felt there's kind of two broad camps in poker. There's the people who are drawn to the gambling aspect and the thrill of the gamble, and then there's the people who are not drawn to the gamble and actually prefer the strategy and all the rest. And I think I've always identified Maria as being in the second camp. Same as us, you know, similar to Maria. Even though I had gambled through my life, I placed my first bet on a horse at four at the age of four in Ireland, which is not unusual in Ireland.
Is that legal in Ireland? Is
Oh,
there
wow, you waited until you were four.
yeah, maybe I was maybe even a little bit late. Typical beginner's luck. I think I bet on three horses and they finished first, third, and fourth. So,
Wow. What are
I
your picks for the next horse race?
Yeah, I should have been hooked for life. But you know, mindless gambling has never appealed to me. I at least want to be able to delude myself into thinking I have some sort of an edge, which I can't do with slots. Similar to Maria, I will never ever play slots. I
Yeah.
just don't see the appeal at all. But you know, there are people that that's the appeal for, and there's nothing wrong with that. One of the great things about poker is it brings these two camps together, the people who like to gamble and the people who like to play strategy games, and it makes it a bigger tent overall.
Well, having just asked about Maria's win there, Dara, you had a winning trip to London for the London Poker Festival. Unibet ran qualifiers for that event. Can you tell us how it went?
Yeah, it went really well. The day before the last flight ran, everybody was walking around and playing the game of how big will the overlay be. Nobody thought they had a hope in hell of reaching the guarantee. They actually got there by, I was going to, by 1.2 players. They literally dribbled across the line, but they somehow got there. Thanks in large part to locals like Terry Jordan and Albert Sapiano, who just kept firing bullets willy-nilly. But yeah, no, it was a great festival overall. It was a thrill for me as well. I backed up day one chip lead in Mystery Bounty, which is good Mystery Bounty strategy because that allows you to win Mystery Bounties on the second day. Ran pretty bad on the second day, but still finished fifth and got three biggish bounties. So that made it a very profitable trip overall. I also cashed the main event. But it was a great festival, a great atmosphere. It sort of fused together the Irish and English poker communities, as our former guest Tom Hall commented on. Tom said every time he comes to Ireland, he realizes that you don't have to be miserable all the time like he feels in England. So he said, you know, the Irish seem to know how to be happy and how to live. And hopefully we brought some of that spirit to London.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's good mystery bounty strategy to bag up the chip lead. It's also good author of the book Mystery Bounty to bag up the mystery bounty chip lead, I think, as well. There was some good salesmanship in that too, Dar.
Yeah, and very good co-author strategy too. He basically took the final table photograph and photoshopped us all calling it all holding a copy of the mystery, which people now believe we actually happened. There are people who actually have false memories of this happening.
Deep fake, deep fake.
Yeah. Well, at this point, I'd like you to ask me the question, how did I get on at the DSO Malta Cup here in Malta, Dar? But I'm
Oh
far
yeah,
too.
you had a deep run too. I saw
Ah,
you.
no, don't bring that up. Ah,
Don't tell
sorry.
Don't tell.
No.
I said the both
You're
of us
embarrassing me.
ones. I didn't really pay much attention to the details since it had nothing to do with me. But please, by all means, tell the waiting chip race nation, David.
No. I prefer them thinking of me as the anchor of this show and not the poker player. But okay, yeah, no, if you insist. I came 10. I actually final table bubbled. I was in good nick. I was 4 of 10, but somehow managed to get 10th out of that. So that was a bit disappointing at the end. But it was a great tournament run by Alex Henry in the Portimão Casino, where of course the DSO sponsored Malta Poker Festival will be in a couple of months' time. So it was kind of a warm up for that months ahead of time. Speaking of live poker, the EPT Paris is coming up this week, and I know for a fact that all three of us will be there. Maria, have you any particular favorite Paris spots?
You know, it's been forever since I've been to Paris. I think it's been almost 10 years. It's such a beautiful, beautiful place. My favorites, I mean, I love Rodin, so I love the Rodin Museum and the Luxembourg Gardens. And for this particular trip, I'm really looking forward to going to the Mark Rothko exhibit at the Fondation Louis Vuitton, which is actually very, very close to the poker venue. So that's going to be a non-poker highlight for me for sure. And I'm someone who loves to eat and to drink good wine. So I have a big list going of places that I will be trying to visit. Hopefully I won't have time to visit all of them because I will be playing wonderful poker and running deep in every event that I play. But on the off chance that I don't final table every single event, I have a list planned out of restaurants that I will be going to that have opened in the last few years.
Nice. Yeah, I did go to the Rodin Museum the last time I was there. And I think if I similarly don't manage to make all my final tables, Musée d'Orsay is
I mean,
always.
it's not likely. Look, it's not likely. We're all three of us are going to be final tabling. So like, this is just, just
Yes.
in case.
Backup plans. Backup plans. Dara, the last time you and I were in Paris, actually, I ended up leaving a part of myself behind. It was the last night of Unibet Open Paris. Do you remember this story?
I remember it very fondly. Just a wonderful night. You had quite obnoxiously won the last side event, and I encourage people to dig out the winner's photo because you will never see a group of people as unhappy for the winner as that particular photograph. Everybody looks like they want to kill you. And then you decided we were having some sort of informal celebration party for this. I think it was a 50 € buy-in or maybe a 100 € buy-in tournament that you won. And
It was 150.
then you got
Dara, you just needed to put that little needle in there, didn't you?
and then he started to get pains, and he realized he was passing a kidney stone, and he was in a lot of agony, which was very, very funny to me, I have to say, until I realized that I was going to have to be the one who was going to have to bring him to hospital. Somehow I got deputized into this role as French speaker slash alleged friend of patient. But it was quite amusing just to see you and A&E begging the nurses to give you morphine or heroin or anything to allay the pain in your pidgin French. And yeah, so that's my main memory, your kidney stone, which you did, I believe, leave in Paris.
You have left out one tiny detail. Everything else is correct, actually, well remembered. Was that we got out of the taxi, which had been booked by Ian Simpson, and arrived at what was not actually a hospital. And then the taxi driver literally threw us out on the road, and you looked at your, Google map and were like, David's about 2 kilometers. Do you think you'll make it? And I was doubling over in pain every 50 meters of that walk.
Yeah,
So you walked the 2 kilometers rather than book
we had
another
no
taxi?
choice. We had zero
Oh
choice.
boy. Sometimes.
Ian sent us to something called the American Hospital of Paris or something like that, which is actually a place where rich Americans go to die. Not an actual hospital. So yeah, there was no staff there.
I'm taking notes for the trip just in case
Yeah,
something happens
definitely
not to
don't
go
go
to the
to an
American
American
hospital.
hospital in Nanterre if you do need a hospital. It sounds
May
reassuring.
nobody listening to the show need any hospital while at the EBT Paris.
Yeah, or at least present not like a heroin addict when they do, so that they don't give you the drugs you really badly need for 4.5 hours. And then when they realize you had a kidney stone, which is what you said you had all the time, they look at the little scan and go, "Oh yeah, kidney stone." And I was like, "Yeah, the kidney stone." As they gave me paracetamol for the first 4 hours, didn't really help much. Anyway, with Paris on everyone's mind right now, I want to give a little shout out to a fantastic piece by Gail Jourdan, who wrote for Poker News a couple of days ago. She wrote, I suppose I'd call it a poker player's guide to Paris. She put together an excellent guide of restaurants and nightlife and sights. This is actually something I did for qualifiers ahead of Unibet Open Malta a couple of years ago. And I think it's a terrific idea and the kind of information that's really valuable to traveling poker players. Obviously, the Maltese one, Dara's going to take the piss now about how we don't actually have any nice restaurants or have any nice sights, aren't you? Now, go on, get it off your chest there.
No, I mean, I don't want to bore. This
Look
is a
at
show
that
you know I'm not a
face.
fan of Maltese cuisine, so.
But
I've had a
see,
quick.
he calls it Maltese cuisine. He acknowledged that something called Maltese cuisine exists.
Yeah, it's
That's
like a, it's a weird mix of English pub food and little bits of Mediterranean sprinkled in, but not enough really to save it all.
interesting. I have never been, so
It's lovely, but it's probably not a great food spot, to be fair. I'm going to zoom in, actually, speaking of food spots, on a few of the food spots that Gail mentioned. There's a place called L'Espadon. It was like a French West African fusion. She said that there's a great place called Les Enfants du Marché, which serves mussels in gorgonzola, which I thought was that was their speciality, which I could definitely have. So I'm drifting into just the food part of the show, which is just for my interest alone. Do you
No,
know
but
else?
can I interrupt you for a second? I
Of
did look up
course.
L'Espadon because it sounded very good. I think the menu starts at over 300 euros a person, prefix
Right, yeah, I
only.
won't be
So
going there.
be careful. Because
Well,
I was like, "Ooh, I want to go to
after
that
we
one."
make one of our final tables
After
together.
I final table the main event, then we can all go to L'Espadon.
Nice, nice. The other one I liked was actually her number one spot was Opier de Cochon, which is obviously famous for its pig's feet because it's literally called pig's feet, which
Yes.
I like the sound of that.
I have been to the pig feet restaurant in past trips.
Yeah. Speaking of pigs and feet and maybe putting a foot into one's mouth if they were a pig. Oh, that's a bad segue. But anyway, I'll get in trouble. I'm already in trouble. It doesn't matter. Phil Hellmuth and his mask comments.
Oh, God.
Well, with one hand, I give it to Poker News, and with the other, I'm about to snatch it away. It wasn't actually just them, to be fair. I think most of the poker media were guilty of this one. And it inspired me to write an article last week. I should suppose I should give a bit of the backdrop in case people don't know the story. Last week, after Phil Hellmuth ran out of presumably name drops or product placements or self-congratulatory remarks during his 2-hour interview, which was very long, with Craig Tapscott for Poker.org, the Poker Brat took a bizarre shot against players who choose to wear a mask at the table. Hellmuth proclaimed that no one should be able to cover their face, and he singled out Haxton as someone who he claims gains an advantage over his opponents by wearing a mask. It was a puerile take backed up by pretty weak arguments for me about the importance of live tells. After Tapscott pushed back a little, Hellmuth said that there could be medical exceptions. He was very decent about this. So I guess he wants people to disclose personal medical information at the cage before all the MTTs. I spoke to KL Cleeton, actually, who thought that his remarks actually reached the level of ableist and, I have to say, I kind of agree. Maria, at the risk of dragging you into it, your thoughts?
I am no, I'm happy to be dragged into it, even though I don't engage in the Twitter discourse, in the sense that I have not commented. But Ike is one of my not just favorite poker players, but one of my favorite people. He
Here.
is just such a decent, amazing human being, and brilliant. And I'm sorry, like, what the actual fuck was my reaction to this? Like, there was just zero reason for it. Ike wears a mask because, hello, like, it's not just COVID. Like, I wear a mask when I travel on airplanes, and I always have one. I don't wear one when I play at the poker table all the time. I used to, but I don't now. But I always have one because if anyone starts coughing or hacking, I'm putting that on because, you know what? I don't care what the hell you have. I don't care if it's a cold. I don't care if it's the flu. I don't care what virus it is. I don't want it. And you know what? After I've started doing that, I don't get sick at poker tournaments basically ever anymore, knock on wood. And I used to basically all the time come home with something or other. And this is something that's totally normalized in lots of parts of the world. And I think it is such absolute bullshit. First of all, that people play when they're sick, like, stay home. And this isn't just playing poker. Like, I grew up, my parents kept me home from school when I was sick. And then other kids would come in. We had perfect attendance awards. What the hell is that, right? Perfect attendance awards? That's rewarding people for coming into school when they're little viral contagion things. That is just totally insane to me. So, like, if you're sick, stay at home. And then if you're playing and someone is sick, you know, fine, wear a mask and don't get yourself sick. Or try, I've tried to give masks to other people when they're clearly sick. That doesn't usually go well. But I always carry some extra just in case. But I mean, poker players are gross. The whole environment is gross. And the fact that just Hellmuth doubled down on this afterwards is just so insane. And by the way, like, let's just look at Ike Haxton's poker career and results online and in person. The mask is not blocking tells. And I have a whole section on this in The Biggest Bluff. There's a ton of psychology research, especially for players as good as, like, do you know how many tells are in the face? Basically zero. And most of the tells are in other parts of the body. like the hands, which are not covered up by a mask. So for someone like Phil to say, "Oh, it's live tells," to me, it's just so disingenuous, and it's gross. And I've only ever had pleasant interactions with Phil, so I was really disappointed. You know, I've always thought that like underneath all that bluster, like there's a good person, there's a kind heart. Like he's, you know, he just kind of blusters because he's an insecure individual just like the rest of us, and that's how it shows. But I've always liked Phil, and this really upset me because, you know, why give the platform to this? You have such a big following, you can do so much good in the poker world. Why take the time to go after one of the good guys, like one of the best guys who's only ever done good things for poker?
Yeah, really well said, Maria. I think Darren, I share your view that Phil is often maybe unfairly critiqued or given out about. You know, he obviously does his sort of poker brat routine, for want of a better phrase. But we've always found him to be actually almost to the point of charming at times in his interviews with us. Certainly in the way that he doesn't mind revealing some of his vulnerabilities and sort of showing maybe, as you said there, some of the maybe deeper psychological reasons for his antics, actually coming from a place people can understand. What probably annoyed me as much as the comments themselves was the fact that the poker media were covering it as a two-side story.
Yeah, I
Like,
hate, so as a journalist, I hate the idea of both sides journalism when it's not both sides, right? Like if an article is both sides of climate change, I'm sorry, like that's not both sides. Like this, there is a scientific fact that has been established. We don't have both sides of the earth is round, right? We don't have half the article about flat earthers telling us, well, here's the reasons that the earth might actually be flat. So have, you know, not every single thing needs both sides. And so that, in a way, when you try to give equal room to both sides, it's not a balanced article actually, because when the consensus is towards one side, and you give extra weight to the other side, then all of a sudden that's when you're writing a biased article.
yeah, in my opinion, this story should have been covered as like famous man says stupid thing and not a, ooh, here's two points of view. Which one do you agree with? You know, a couple of years, and obviously this just everybody knows this anyway, but like a couple of years after a global pandemic prompted worldwide lockdowns and people are still immunocompromised and suffering from health issues, respiratory issues, or they're even just, you know, doing it as a precaution because they know people, they'll know they're going to come across their granny or their elderly parent or whatever the next week. It's absolutely insane. I think it was really asinine that it was covered in this way. Dara, was I too harsh, however, on some of the poker writers? And in a more general sense, are there certain topics, building on what Maria said there, which don't need to be two sides or both sides? Obviously, the ones she said were are very obvious, but are there other things maybe within poker?
Yeah, I think I think there are in general, but I think part of the issue is that while we are all on the same side of this thing, which is totally not two sides, but there are a lot of high profile poker players who would agree with Phil on this stuff. And that's that does create the illusion, at least, of, well, there's two sides to the story. There's one camp who believes one thing and another camp who believes the other, which is not necessarily reflected to the same degree in the world at large. Poker seems this weird microcosm of where we seem to have an unusual amount of conspiracy theorists and unusual amounts of science deniers, et cetera, which is bizarre considering that poker is a game which is supposed to teach critical thinking. And but nevertheless, that's where we are. So, you know, I have some sympathy for writers. Also, you know, writers have to be read, as you know well, David. So, I didn't think you were unfair in your article, but I did understand why Phil might feel that it was a bit one-sided because he is used to more to an easier ride from other writers, and you certainly didn't give him that. Although you did say in the article that you liked him when we've interviewed him on the show, and I'm also very fond of Phil. Had a great time the few times we've had him on the show, and the few times I've played with him in person, he's been great fun at the table. So this is nothing at all against Phil. This is just an issue that we happen to disagree on. But yeah, it's. To be fair to Phil, you know, when you are at his level, people tend to just say what you want to hear, and you have the whole echo chamber problem. He may feel that his views are more widespread than they actually are because of that. But Yeah, I mean, the poker media is the poker media. We've talked about it in the past. It's essentially a trade press, or at best, and at worst, it's just affiliate sites dressed up as legitimate journalistic content. And Phil is very good at playing to the crowd as well. I mean, if he had given a well-reasoned argument, this story wouldn't have got as much air.
Fair point. Well, moving on to another subject, which I wrote about last week, the story of Carel Souma leaving his bag behind in the Wynn and decorated poker pro Anthony Zinno picking it up. Despite rumors swirling around and even some outcry by Souma, this story was actually not covered for quite some time. I heard about it first, probably a month ago. I think that's because Zinno has a pristine record in the community and people just didn't want it to be true and certainly didn't want to be the first to say something and then it turned out not to be true. And then, that would feel very, very bad to blacken someone's name in that way. However, I think eventually it just, certainly when a victim is shouting out about it as much as Carel did, I think the story had to be run and pretty much everyone did run it. Short version of this one is after bagging up in a tournament during the WPT World Championship in the Wynn, Tuma left his bag containing cash at the table. According to Tuma, when the bag was retrieved, it was light and the person implicated was WPT and WSOP champion Ant Zinno. What's not under dispute is that Zinno picked up the unattended bag under the table as players were bagging, that he didn't give it to staff and instead took it from the room, that he eventually turned it into the Wynn Lost and Found, that he was cited for petty larceny and released on December 19th, and that he has not been charged at this time with the crime. Other details being alleged are that Zinno took the bag to the bathroom where there were no cameras, that he went across the street to the Cosmopolitan with the bag, that he had been barred by the Wynn. And of course, the more salient detail that the bag had contained 20K, but had just 1K in it when it was given back to Tuma. Darragh, this one just doesn't look great for Zinno, right?
No, it really doesn't. I mean, I don't really know Ant very well. I played with him a few times, been pleasant at the table, but I can't really claim to know him or speak to his likely integrity. The details that have emerged do look very damning. His defense was that he was trying to locate the person whose bag it was, but I think Sean Deeb probably just nailed it best of all in his wonderfully get right to the heart of the matter in coherent fashion on Twitter when he put out a tweet basically saying, look, why wouldn't you just hand it in security? That's pretty much the sort of very basic point. I think if anybody found a bag and they had good intentions, unless they knew the person very well, that's what they would do. You had a bag go missing in Barcelona a few years ago, and so
What are you saying? And Zinho was in Barcelona in
Well, that was the first
2022.
thing. That was the first message I sent you when the story broke was Ancino in Barcelona that time, because we never actually got to the bottom of that one. Luckily, you're not as rich as this poor unfortunate who's had 19K stolen off him. But
The guy who
yeah,
took
no,
my
it,
bag
it
ended up with a wet pair of swim shorts, just for the
yeah, it looks
record.
really bad. But at the end of the day, we are just talking. This is all circumstantial. We're all just talking about what we've heard about. So
Sure.
you know, I don't want to impugn Ant's character. It doesn't look good, but that doesn't mean anything. That just still doesn't mean anything. Yeah, that's pretty much all I can say.
Maria, it seems to me that there will, of course, be the burden of proof that there was 20K in the bag. But even if that can be, if it cannot be proved, the problem for Zinno here is he did the wrong thing, not hand the bag, in my opinion, like whatever about the security, just give it straight to the dealer who's literally sitting in front of the guy's name at that seat.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, look, I think that Dara said it well in the sense that I don't have any additional details. I don't know. I like Ant personally,
Same.
but that's not a reason, right, to not look at evidence. That's, I have met a lot of people who are very personable and lovely and then do something shitty. And those two things, unfortunately, the one doesn't mean the other can't happen. And I have no idea what happened, but all I know is that when you see anything that someone left behind, I mean, how is your first instinct not to immediately call the floor, call security, give it to the dealer? Like, that's just what you do. And you said, unless it's someone who's a close friend, I would actually do it even if it were a good friend, unless I knew I was going to see that good friend in the next, however many hours, because it's a pain in the ass to try to track someone down during a poker tournament. So like, let's imagine that this was Eric Seidel, my coach, right, with whom I'm very close, and he left something and I knew it was Eric's. I would text him immediately and be like, hey, you left this. Do you want me to give it? I'm going to give it to security so that you can pick it up first thing when you get here, so that you're not tied to my schedule. I'm not tied to your schedule, right? My first instinct is always to just give it to someone and that's it. You know, I don't have the time to be involved in it. And that's just what you do. And the other thing that just did not, I mean, when you're bagging up, there are tons of people in the room. There's a dealer at every single table. The floor staff are still there. The security staff are there. And just there's no, you should never be leaving the poker room with somebody else's property. You know, it's especially a bag. This is something that I think is just 101.
Yeah, I think that's it in a nutshell. Like, once a person does that, they don't protect themselves. So even if they think they're the most honest person in the world, will never do anything wrong. They've made a mistake where they can end up in trouble at a later point. And I think, unfortunately, in this one, whether or not it's been able to prove that there was actually 20 grand in the bag or not, in the court of public opinion, this is always going to be viewed suspiciously as behavior that you did at some time. And I don't really see how he'll get around that. What I will say finally, though, just because I want to be fair, is last week Ant broke his silence on the matter, tweeting. And I'd like to just read that out just so that, you know, I've put his version, if you like, on the record. He said, I'd like to share some thoughts and I'll provide all details after the legal matter finishes. We had all made it to the money, which ended that day. The ballroom was shut down for the night. I stood up to leave and then noticed a bag close by. My first instinct, it was late at night, was that I'd assume responsibility for the bag and get it to the owner myself, figuring that they went home. My goal was to find ID or verify ownership by some means, so effectively going into the bag, try to contact the owner or mutual friends and perhaps meet somewhere on the strip or at the restart. Unsuccessful, I brought the bag to Encore, lost and found, slept, and then played day two. I absolutely deny what's being alleged. Just want to put that on the record because that's the only thing he's actually been happy to say at this point. Given the fact that he's lawyered up, one would presume that this story will take some time to fully unfold, and or maybe even we never, as I said, get total clarity on what happened there. But anyway, unfortunate story. And that brings us to our final topic, actually. Maria, you are working on a new book, which I know is about cheaters. I don't know if it has a working title yet. What can you tell us about it? And does it feature any poker stories?
So it is about cheating in the world of games. So that does include poker. So yes, it will include poker stories, but it's not just poker, right? So we have games like chess and poker, also sports, which are also games, and any basically competitive arenas where the spirit of the thing is the competition, right? Where the cheating actually goes against the heart of what the game is about, right? So I've already written a book about con artists, which is very different. So I'm not talking about that. I'm not going to be writing about fraud or, you know, just things like that. I'm interested in, you know, those stories where, you know, you betray the principles of the thing that you were doing and the reasons why people play this. And obviously, you know, there are cases where it's pretty clear, like, okay, money, right? But there are other cases where, like, there's no money. Like, who the hell cheats at a home Monopoly game? It happens, right? and it's actually like a microcosm of the exact same thing. Like, there are people who like cheat at things that are just, you just think, why in the world are you doing this? But that's what interests me, kind of that impulse, and those types of stories. And so for anyone listening, I'm still, you know, I'm still writing, I'm still researching. So if you have good cheating stories or insights into cheating stories that have already broken, I think the last few years have just been insane in terms of how much cheating has been in the news. But yeah, if there's anything that people want to say, they should absolutely feel free to reach out to me.
Yeah, obviously, as a poker player, I think of the various cheating scandals we've had, the big ones, I suppose, Pat Ripper, and more recently, maybe Imsurovich and Schindler and the allegations against Brin. I also think of other game cheats, too, though. So, for example, and then this one, I don't know if it's something you've seen or maybe you saw the movie. Actually, it wasn't a movie, it was a TV show. But Charles Ingram, one of the most famous cheater stories in recent memory, was a British Army major who appeared on The British Who Wants to Be a Millionaire in 2001. He won the top prize. His friend and wife were in the audience and they were coughing really loudly as the right answer was being said. And after the tapings, the producer were really, they were really suspicious of his sort of way he circled back on answers and different things like that. And you know, once they turned up the volume in the audience, they heard the coughing and then,
The
you know,
coughing.
figured out what happened. A TV show was made about it, actually. It was called Quiz, in which Succession star Matthew McFadden plays Ingram in it. And actually, it's a good story, although obviously it's a very well-known one. So I don't know if that's of any use to you, Maria. But there is a certain satisfaction when a cheater gets caught and there's an immediate rightful punishment, whether that's Ingram not getting his million quid or actually the fact that I think he had to pay damages as well. The problem is, though, a lot of the time, the retribution doesn't happen. The players who steal money at the poker tables just get it confiscated. The best case scenario maybe is the player who got robbed gets what was theirs back again. You're in the confidence game. You made the point that often there's the dynamic where the con artist fucks with the victim so badly that they actually end up still defending them afterwards. And I'm interested if you've already in your research noticed a similar dynamic with victims of cheaters.
So I think it's not quite the same dynamic because obviously some cheaters are con artists, but a lot of cheaters aren't. But there is a lot of there's a dynamic of people who don't want this to become public for various reasons, and that's a similar dynamic to cons, where it's whether it's because you're embarrassed or some other situation, you don't actually want this to come out as the victim, and so you help cover it up in a way. And a lot of times, when it comes to something like poker, when it comes to that kind of cheating, a lot of times there's zero legal recourse. So you're like, well, what am I going to do? Like, I can't get this money back. And there are a lot of so what I have come across. There are a few stories that I can't get the confirmations that I need to be able to write them that haven't. That I know happened, right? Like I have done enough research to be satisfied. Like I've done my journalistic duty, but I haven't done my legal duty, in the sense that I can't get that final kind of confirmation that yes, this actually happened, because there are other bigger forces that want to keep it quiet, corporate forces, you know, people who weren't involved in the cheating but are involved in the cover-up of the cheating because they don't want to look bad. They don't want their establishments to look bad. And a lot of people are scared. So that's actually a much greater force in cheating stories than I've seen in other research, where a lot of people don't want to talk to me because they're afraid that they're gonna get hurt, like physically hurt.
Wow.
That they'll get in trouble for talking, because a lot of times if someone cheats you in a game, they're not the best person and they are not necessarily tied to the best people. So it can be very difficult getting people to come clean, and it can be difficult to prove things. And if you feel helpless, right, that I'm not going to get this money back anyway, then you might think, like, what's the point, right? Why talk about it? And that's really frustrating and also very sad to me. But I will say that from what I've kind of uncovered, as far as poker goes, I will never be playing in a home game.
Sure. Well, Dara, I think of you and I as maybe two of the shrewder, more careful people out there in the poker world. Obviously, money gets kind of handed over and people loan each other money and different things happen. And, you know, we're in games that cheating could take place. Well, I would think of the two of us as, you know, fairly careful on the spectrum of people, but nonetheless, you know, both of us have been cheated that we know of on a few occasions. And at the risk of getting a bit philosophical here, Nietzsche said, "I'm not upset that you deceive me. I'm upset that from now on I can't believe you." That's also what happens, I think, when people cheat. The people who get cheated, they feel a greater loss beyond what they've been cheated out of, right?
That's right. And I think that was very unusually philosophical for Dominic to have said that. But I mean that's it. It does just undercut your whole faith in humanity. And you know, Maria's book about con men, you know, people prefer to live in a world where they can trust people. And anything that erodes that is deeply upsetting. We have been cheated on numerous occasions and on that we know about, and obviously on numerous other occasions that we don't even know about. some of which we suspect, some of which we may not even suspect, right across the spectrum of like live games we played in, online games we played in, stakes we've taken in people, right across the spectrum. It's just sort of part of the price of doing business, in the same way that companies write off a certain amount of their goods as being pilfered. It's an unfortunate reality. What you don't want it to happen is for it to get so great that it just undermines the whole enterprise, which luckily has never happened in poker. But there is an interesting contrast in poker culturally between the world that I was in just before poker, the running world. Now, in the running world, the incentives are very, very heavily aligned towards cheating, because you have a lot of runners. Their only way they're ever going to make a lot of money is if they cheat. And that's true for the vast majority of runners. Yet the vast majority of runners don't cheat. And the ones who do cheat are absolutely shunned by the community. Nobody will ever shake their hand again or greet them warmly at an event. That doesn't happen in poker. We see the cheats walking among us, people going up asking them for selfies, still treating them as celebrities. And that's a real difference between the two worlds. And I think it's a crucial difference, because if there was less tolerance of cheaters and scam artists of all types in poker, then I think that would stop some people. It wouldn't stop everybody, because some people, it's just about the money, but it would at least stop some people.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there are a number of cheating scandals in running. You know, one of my favorites is Rosie Ruiz from the Boston Marathon. This is a long time ago, 1980, who won the marathon in record time. she was great. And then it turned out she took the subway for parts of the route. but
maybe if it's funny enough, crazy. It should be allowed. I don't know.
No, I mean,
Some of the early ones are very funny. Like, they're pretty sure the first London Olympics that most of the participants at some point hopped into a car and just because there were no officials, nobody thought to have officials. And then the Paris Olympics, I think around the turn of the last century, it was so disorganized that nobody really knew what the course was. So pretty much everybody got lost. And the guy who eventually got to the finish line, nobody knew whether he got there by the right course or not, but they just kind of had to accept it.
But, you know, Darragh, that's a really interesting point that you make about London, that they didn't have officials, because this actually goes into like the national character, where like gentleman's code, right? No one would cheat, right? This is an honorable society, which is how con artists are able to do what they do. And why you would, I mean, if I think about it, right, as someone who's a psychologist and who's been deep in this world, I would say, like, are you insane, right, to not have people checking at every single point? And yet there's the, oh, well, you know, we can do an entire race with lots of money and prestige and all sorts of stuff at stake with a total honor system. And that just is such a different mindset that quite amusing in a non-amusing way.
Now, that's interesting, because I even know from the cricket world how at least there was a time where it was almost like an English gentleman's thing that you would never, you just have the spirit of the laws of cricket and that should cover you for everything, because no one would be so shameless as to, you know, cheat. But actually, in reality, there was loads of cheating going on. Actually, probably cricket might be the most cheesy sport there is out there these days, with all the opportunities for spot fixing and whatever. So, I think maybe as time goes by, a level of sophistication of the cheater just or just the brazenness of them means that you have to abandon all gentlemen's agreements if that's what we're calling them. Finally, Maria, just before we let you go, I was just wondering, how far along are you on this book? Like, I imagine you probably don't tell anybody you're working on a book until you get a little bit into it. And then I suppose how long before we can expect the release?
If optimistically 2025. Yeah, definitely not this year. I mean, these take a while, and I still have a few stories that I need to nail down.
Well, we look forward to having you on the show about that book in 2027 in that case.
I love the optimism and the belief in me. Thank you so much.
On that note, it remains for me to thank our fabulous guest this week, Maria Konnikova.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always such a pleasure. I always look forward to our conversations.
And Darragh, thank you also.
Thank you, David, and thank you, Maria. I'm glad we're still at the stage in this book with Maria when we can ask her when it'll come out, because I do remember on the poker book there came a point where that question wasn't allowed anymore.
This is true. This is true.
Take care,
you
everyone.
Have one thank more. You have. You guys have one more time, and then I'm cutting you off.
Deal. That seems fair.
Take care, everyone. See you in Paris.